A whole lot of us go through life assuming that we are basically right, basically all the time, about basically everything, about our political and intellectual convictions, our religious and moral beliefs, our assessment of other people, our memories, our grasp of facts. As absurd as this may sound, when we stop to think about it, our steady state seems to be one of unconsciously assuming that we are very close to omniscient. This is a quote from Catherine Schultz in her book, Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. Welcome to episode 2 of the Faith Transition Podcast. I want to thank NRSNG, top company nationwide for nursing students, for letting me use their studio to record this podcast. If you are a nursing student and would like to really nail your test and get amazing tools for success, you need to check their website at nrsng.com and you'll find all the goodies you need. In this episode, I will dig deeper into the meaning of faith crisis and faith transition. I will share some personal experiences to illustrate. I will share some interesting data findings, which were shared in a paper by Clayton Christensen from Harvard Business School, originally intended to help the leaders of the Mormon Church to understand what a faith crisis is, the reasons that cause it, how many are increasingly affected by it, and how they can get ahead on the issue. I won't focus on that part much, but if you want to, you can read their paper online. I will put the description below. In this episode, I will also share some of the books and tools that helped me clear the clutter in my mind as I went through the faith crisis and faith transition, and ultimately helped me find the inner peace we all long to have. Not to say that it is constant, because our humanness doesn't allow for that, but it's way better than the chaos I was in when I started questioning everything. I will share where I stand spiritually today. I hope you enjoy. As I was preparing my notes for this second episode and doing a little bit of research about, you know, faith crisis and, you know, wanting to provide definitions for maybe people who still are, you know, trying to understand what it is and how it happens and whatnot, I came across this paper, which was written in June 2013, specifically prepared for President Dieter Uchtdorf at the time. And it's titled LDS Personal Faith Crisis. And it's written by Clayton M. Christensen from Harvard Business School. And it's available online if you want to look up the whole thing. I'm just only going to share a few parts of it because it was really eye-opening and interesting. And I was actually impressed that, you know, this was actually done for the leadership in Brethren. I have no idea, you know, what happened with it or after, or if they took into consideration. They must have, I'm assuming, because they did come up with, you know, you saw the theme coming up in like general conferences and things like that after that. So I'm just going to assume that they saw this and maybe did something about it. But basically, from October 2011 until August 2013, an unpaid team of scholars, strategists, and other volunteers conducted the research, summarizing findings and developed a number of strategic recommendations aimed to help LDS leaders better understand and be more compassionate about members of the church going through a faith crisis. So they wanted to explain, you know, what it means and the turmoil that it results from, you know, discovering church history facts that do not align with the traditional narrative of the church. So the Faith Crisis Project was self-initiated. It would, you know, nobody, they were not paid for it, and they just wanted to inform the brethren, I guess. So I thought that was pretty awesome that they would just, this group of people would take that upon themselves and do that, just kind of scholarly research about it all. So the definition they give of a faith crisis is, a faith crisis is defined as a state of intense emotional and spiritual distress resulting from the discovery of church history facts that do not align with the traditional LDS narrative. This distress results in members losing faith in some or all foundational truth claims of the LDS Church and in the church itself. Now, here are some interesting data-driven findings that they shared with the leaders. They said, our data show a significant number of church leaders who have traditionally been stalwart, active, and highly committed are leaving the church or lapsing into long-term inactivity, resulting in a void of local leadership. When long-time members go inactive as a result of faith crisis, a large ripple effect is created within their families, wards, and stakes. This ripple effect that causes others to lose faith may not be detected for months or even years from the point of first exposure. Not addressing the faith crisis issue will compound the challenge for future leaders and future generations of members. While it was not uncommon in our recent past for left-leaning individuals to struggle in their faith over doctrinal issues such as blacks in the priesthood or gays, our data suggests that an increasing number of individuals and families from the middle are losing faith and reducing or eliminating church activity as a result of faith crisis. Then they go into the need for metrics. They say traditionally the church has measured loss of faith and disaffection by tracking the number of resignation letters received at church headquarters. Unfortunately, this traditional measurement vastly underrepresents the faith crisis challenge because a large segment of those who have lost faith remain active or semi-active in the church. Just under half of our faith crisis survey respondents who had lost all faith continue to attend meetings. These active but faithless members have no reason to submit resignation letters. And I can tell you, I know lots of those people who are basically non-believers, just kind of going because of their spouse or going because, you know, I don't know, their kids are still active or whatnot, but I can just see them like, I interact with them all the time. The majority of those who completely disengage from the church do not submit resignation letters. That's me. Many view this as an unnecessary offense to believing family members and friends. That's not my reasons, but yeah, I fit in that category. Some do not wish to invest the time in the multiple step process. Some do not wish to recognize the church's authority by submitting a resignation letter. And perhaps some wish to hedge their bets by remaining on the church rolls. Measuring the severity of faith crisis by simply tracking numbers of resignations creates a false impression there is no formidable challenge and causes many to deny the severity of the issue. It will not serve us well if we have faith crisis deniers in the same way we now have climate change deniers. I absolutely love this because it is so, so true. Like these numbers of active, and I'm putting quotes around that word, members of the church is absolutely not real and true as far as like faith goes. A lot less. I would easily cut that in half. And I do think John Dellen probably has one of his Mormon stories on that. I think I may have, there's just so many of them, hundreds of them, but I'm sure you can find a Mormon story speaking very clearly on like data and how, you know, there are a lot of the discrepancies in the data presented during general conferences and the actual reality of who's active, who's not, and whatnot. Now, the reason people leave the church by order of most given answers to least given answers, and these people now interviewed, surveyed thousands of people. So that's a lot more than my little survey that I did, you know, in 2015 that I referred to in the first episode. But all of the answers that I did dig as I did my own survey, I had no idea about this or any, you know, research that had been done. I just did my own thing. They all fit into these reasons that they are giving here as to why people leave the church. They may not be in the same exact order, but they are all named in here. So these are the reasons by order of importance, again, that they found in their survey. One was, I ceased to believe the doctrine theology. Next was, I studied church history and lost my belief. I lost faith in Joseph Smith. I lost faith in the Book of Mormon. I lost confidence in the general authorities' church stance on women. I did not feel spiritually edified at church. The church stands on homosexuals / pro-paid. Church stands on race issues. Church stands on science matters. I became bothered by church culture. I reevaluated what it means to believe, to know. I lost confidence in local church leaders. I lost my faith in God. I lost my faith in Jesus. I didn't receive the promised spiritual witness. I received the spiritual witness to leave the church. Lack of meaningful friendships within the church. I or someone was abused by someone at the church. I was offended by someone, that's like bottom, and then wanting to drink alcohol or extramarital sex is a zero for both of these things. That's never a real reason why people leave. So, but I like the fact that I was offended by someone is like at the very, very bottom. That means very few people gave that as a reason. And that is the number one reason, at least as I was growing up, people would always give for people leaving the church. It was, oh, they were offended by someone. Well, this, you know, survey of thousands of people who have left shows that that's not the case. Now, in order to better understand what faith crisis is about, I think it is vital to look into James Fowler's Stages of Faith. Now, that's a book that came out in 1981. So it's, you know, way before this whole flood of faith crisis in the Mormon faith. This was not invented for today, but it just really enlightens, you know, those going through faith crisis of faith or faith transition. I just want to briefly read what all the stages are, just in case, you know, you don't have time to go and look it up. You can just listen to it on your drive right now, because I'm sure some of you are like, oh, I'm going to go pick that up, but then it won't happen. So just so you can have an idea, and after listening to this, you can be more enlightened as to what James Fowler's stages of faith are. So stage number one is intuitive projective. And the way he describes it is this is the stage of preschool children in which fantasy and reality often get mixed together. However, during this stage, our most basic ideas about God are usually picked up from our parents and or society. He says people stuck at this stage are usually self-centered and often find themselves in trouble due to their unprincipled living. If they do end up converting to the next stage, it often occurs in a very dramatic way. Stage two is mythic literal. When children become school age, they start understanding the world in more logical ways. They generally accept the stories told to them by their faith community, but tend to understand them in very literal ways. A few people remain in this stage through adulthood. Quite frankly, I don't know if it's a few. I think it's a lot. Basically, yes, I'm not going to go into, you know, what adult people may sometimes believe in, thinking it is still true, but just look around and pay attention and you'll find people who still believe literally in certain things. Stage three, synthetic conventional. Most people move on to this stage as teenagers. At this point, their life has grown to include several different social circles, and there is a need to pull it all together. When this happens, a person usually adopts some sort of all-encompassing belief system. However, at this stage, people tend to have a hard time seeing outside their box and don't recognize that they are inside a belief system. At this stage, authority is usually placed in individuals or groups that represent one's beliefs. This is the stage in which many people remain. At this stage, he says, people rely on some sort of institution, such as a church, to give them stability. They become attached to the forms of their religion, and they get extremely upset when these are called into question. That's stage three. I think I remain there for the majority of my life. I can honestly say I was at stage three because I was upset when, you know, my beliefs were questioned, and I was, you know, I was very, very set in my ways, thinking that was the only way. Stage four, individuative reflective. This is the tough stage, often begin in young adulthood when people start seeing outside the box and realizing that there are other boxes. They begin to critically examine their beliefs on their own and often become disillusioned with their former faith. Ironically, the stage 3 people usually think that stage 4 people have become backsliders, when in reality they have actually moved forward. So that's skeptic individual. Those who break out the previous stage usually do so when they start seriously questioning things on their own. A lot of the time, this stage ends up being very non-religious. People in this stage end up being very non-religious, and some people stay in it permanently. So I would definitely say that stage 4 is the where if you're going through a faith crisis and all the turmoil and everything like that, as far as spirituality goes, that is stage 4. And I remember very clearly feeling and living, and it's a tough stage to be at, to be honest, because you're really destroying everything that was given to you and trying to reconstruct, and it's a very confusing stage, but it's an important stage. Stage 5 is called conjunctive faith. It is rare for people to reach this stage before midlife. This is the point when people begin to realize the limits of logic and start to accept the paradoxes in life. They begin to see life as a mystery and often return to sacred stories and symbols, but this time without being stuck in a theological box. It's called the mystical communal. People who reach this stage start to realize that there is truth to be found in both the previous two stages, and that life can be paradoxical and full of mystery. Emphasis is placed more on community than on individual concerns. I also remember, you know, when after the big, you know, faith crisis and my earthquake and everything falling apart and me rejecting just about everything and everything that was given to me, coming back, you know, when things calmed down, it was easier for me to, you know, take back some of the good things I had received while leaving aside, you know, the other things that I didn't agree with her. But yeah, just combining, realizing that there is good to be found, you know, everywhere. And I'm definitely anti-box and anti-institution, and I don't fit in. I don't want walls around me. I just, you know, want to feel free and be free. Now, I am still communal in the sense that I am more than happy to take my kids and go do service, even if it's organized by a church in my neighborhood. Like, I'm absolutely for serving and not being self-centered. But again, I put a distinction between doing good, being good for goodness sake, and because, you know, we are all one part of this earth and universe, but not because, you know, a certain church said so or is directing it or, you know, telling you to do so. And now the final stage, stage 6, is universalizing faith. Few people reach this stage. Those who do live their lives to the full in service of others without any real worries of doubts. I think I'm kind of sitting between stage 5 and 6. Why? Because of course I haven't, like, you know, shut down everything and quit my job to go and serve somewhere and spend the rest of my life doing that. I mean, I would love to do that. I would actually be happy if I could do that. It's just I don't have that luxury. I'm a mother of 3 and have responsibilities. So I can't be, you know, a meditating monk somewhere in a mountain and just, you know, spend my days doing that and service. But ideally, I would love to just take off to Bali again and do that and do service, you know, for the rest of my life. But I do believe that as far as my beliefs go, universalizing faith, I am definitely evolving in that direction. I call myself spiritual non-religious. I do believe in connectivity. I do believe that what I used to call the spirit, feeling the spirit, and that spirit tells you this is true or not. I mean, I don't use these terms anymore. I don't think that's, I feel like I'm beyond that, not in a arrogant way, but I do believe that feeling connected is a universal thing, because you feel connected to the people around you or to nature or to something bigger. It's just feeling connected, not so much, you know. And of course we use the terms that we have been given, that we have learned. We're very, very limited in our vocabulary. So Christians will call that the spirit or other, you know, denomination. But for me, a universal word would be just connection, feeling connected. So, and that is to me what I meant, you know, in when I mentioned in the first episode, the universal sacred, I guess he calls it universalizing faith, meaning that you see good where good is at, truth basically testify for itself. You tap into that, you recognize it, you live it, you know, you're true to, you know, how truth manifests itself, and you don't try to accommodate a certain religion or a certain way to be. Like you it's just, yeah, it's just not in a box. And it's something I think everyone who keeps evolving discovers, because I come around people and we start talking and they're like, yeah, I've came to the same conclusion, you know, just be good, you know, for goodness sake, do as well as you can. There is no need for boxing things, you know, but there is a way of being and feeling more connected to people around you and to nature. And I think we all long for that and somehow crave it, just that feeling of connection. And we can create it by respect and tolerance and being kind and good to each other. That's how we maintain that connectivity and being good, you know, to our Mother Earth, which is really needed at this time. So that was the six stages of faith as described by James Fowlers. I will read to you 10 quotes from 10 books, because I had to put a number, because I could do this all day, even all week. So 10 books that really transformed me, books that ignited parts of my brain that needed to be ignited in order for me to evolve. I'm not saying that they are the best books ever written in the world, but they are books that spoke to my soul. And of course, there are many more I have read that have impacted me, but I had to pick a few related to this period of my life. So the order is simply the order that I read them and not the order of importance. The first one is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. That book I read a little bit after I got back from a mission back in 1999. And that book really impacted me deeply, because in one sentence, it puts everything in perspective. I mean, when you read his story, you understand. So what I'll do is I will just read a quote from each one of the books so that you can have a little bit an idea of what's inside. And if you haven't read the book, you can go and pick it up, or you can tell me in the comments if you've read them and what you think about it. So Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. Everything can be taken from a man, but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. The Road Less Traveled by M. Scott Peck. Life is difficult. This is a great truth. One of the greatest truths. It is a great truth because once we truly see this truth, we transcend it. Once we truly know that life is difficult, once we truly understand and accept it, then life is no longer difficult. Because once it is accepted, the fact that life is difficult no longer matters. The Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu. Simplicity, patience, compassion. These three are your greatest treasures. Simple in actions and thoughts, you return to the source of being. Patient with both friends and enemies, you accord with the way things are. Compassionate toward yourself, you reconcile all beings in the world. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Knowing others is intelligence, knowing yourself is true wisdom. Mastering others is strength, mastering yourself is true power. Daring Greatly, How the Courage to be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead by Brené Brown. Now, she had really great impact on my transformation during my faith crisis and my faith transition. I mean, her books really helped me create a new foundation for myself when I had basically rejected everything I received and rebuilt, you know, my own foundation. And that doesn't mean I didn't take back some of the good things I had been given from my former faith, the faith of my childhood, Mormonism. Basically, I took all the good and left all the bad things that, you know, I disagreed with. But she was just a really impactful character in helping me rebuild myself. So here's a couple of quotes. Courage starts with showing up and letting ourselves be seen. Because true belonging only happens when we present our authentic, imperfect selves to the world, our sense of belonging can never be greater than our level of self-acceptance. Vulnerability is the birthplace of love, belonging, joy, courage, empathy, and creativity. It is the source of hope, empathy, accountability, and authenticity. If we want greater clarity in our purpose, our deeper and more meaningful spiritual lives, vulnerability is the path. Next is Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margins of Error by Catherine Scholes. Now that book really helped me coping with the fact that in the end, I kind of had been wrong my whole life about, you know, what is the one and only path to go. That was wrong, because it is. Maybe not for everyone, but for me, it is. There is not one and only way, you know, to either find happiness or go to heaven or whatever it is, you know, we want to believe in. And just as an adult, and I think a lot of people are very afraid of that, is especially when it's like a lifelong type of thing, realization to accept or admit that you were wrong all along. That alone, I think, will turn away some people, you know, turn them away from having the courage to look at what is actually real and true, because it's just too much work and too much pain to go through. And I can understand that. I can understand that it's, you know, better not know sometimes, because it will involve, you know, pain, but then what a liberation afterwards. So here's a couple of quotes from her book. Our love of being right is best understood as our fear of being wrong. To err is to wonder, and wondering is the way we discover the world, and lost in thoughts, it is also the way we discover ourselves. Being right might be gratifying, but in the end, it is static, a mere statement. Being wrong is hard and humbling, and sometimes even dangerous, but in the end, it is a journey and a story. Who really wants to stay at home and be right when you can put on your armor, spring up on your steed, and go forth to explore the world? True, you might get lost along the way, get stranded in a swamp, have a scare at the edge of a cliff. Thieves might steal your gold, brigands might imprison you in a cave, sorcerers might turn you into a toad. But what if to fuck up is to find adventure? It is in this spirit that this book is written. Next is my man, Jonathan Hyde. I really like him. He's a professor. He has just some great explanation as to societal, you know, situation, political situation. I just like his perspective. So if you haven't seen him on, you know, TED Talks or different interviews, Jonathan Hyde, just Google his name. I will put the link below too. And you'll find all the great things that he puts out there to really help humanity think a little deeper. So in his book, The Happiness Hypothesis, he says, happiness is not something that you can find, acquire, or achieve directly. You have to get the conditions right and then wait. Some of those conditions are within you, such as coherence among the parts and levels of your personality. Other conditions require relationships to things beyond you. Just as a plant needs sun, water, and good soil to thrive, people need love, work, and a connection to something larger. It is worth striving to get the right relationships between yourself and others, between yourself and your work, and between yourself and something larger than yourself. If you get these relationships right, a sense of purpose and meaning will emerge. Love and work are to people what water and sunshine are to plants. Next is Choose the Life You Want by Tal Ben-Shahar. He is an American-Israeli professor from Harvard University and kind of a voice in positive psychology, more than a voice, a researcher, and wrote some books about it. So in this book, he really talks about how we choose the, like the title says, we choose the life we want by making these conscious decisions to make our life what we want it to be. So sometimes, you know, when we lack direction, we don't know where to go, how to build, how to rebuild, especially in this particular case where I'm thinking my audience is mostly people who have had faith crisis or transitioning phase, questioning, hurting, and maybe having a lot of questions, not knowing how to rebuild. I think this book really helps finding ways, concrete ways to do these things. So here's a quote from the book. He says, "Choices is creation. To choose is to create. Through my choices, I create my reality. At every moment in my life, I have a choice. Moments add up to a lifetime. Choices add up to a life. What kind of life do I want for myself? What choices will create this kind of life?" The next book I want to bring up is Escape by Carolyn Jessup. Now, that book I read kind of at the very budding stages of me starting to question my foundation. So I read her book. Now, Carolyn Jessup grew up in the FLDS polygamous community, and her book Escape is just really eye-opening, at least for, you know, anyone who has any interest in the FLDS community. I mean, I was kind of discovering the FLDS as I read her book. Like, I had heard about it but never really digged into it or tried to find out. I mean, of course, Mormonism has a lot of branches like RLDS and FLDS and whatever else. I mean, I know there are a bunch of them, but I never really digged into that. Not quite sure how her book came into the radar for me, but I just picked it up and listened to her telling her story, and I was just floored and shocked, and and mostly I was very impressed by her courage to leave that community after really generations of being there. So I highly encourage the book to anyone who's a little bit interested in that. So she says, in a cult, you have two identities, your cult identity and your authentic self. Most of the time I operated from my cult identity, which was pliant, submissive, and obedient. But when I was pushed to the point where it felt like my survival was at stake, my authentic self came to the fore. And that's a little bit what happens with, you know, whether you're in a very extreme type cultish community or even mild, or I think that's really what happened to people who experience faith crisis. At some point, they are just pushed. They experience what I discovered later on as what is cognitive dissonance. And, you know, your authentic self start to disagree with the way you are supposed to be, the way, you know, you're supposed to represent and just agree with leadership and all that stuff. Like, at some point, you know, for people who listen to their authentic self and listen to their true conscience, their true self starts becoming louder and louder. And you know, we choose to follow that and not what we were told to do or follow. She says also, "I could not undo overnight the damage that had been done to my psyche over many years. The only way over was through. I knew that, but it was still debilitating and stressful. All I could do was face the fear and keep going." Next one is Troublemaker by Lea Rimini, the actress. Now, that book is eye-opening, but also very funny. I read that book while I was in the midst of my faith crisis, like at the heat of it, and I was being very outspoken and writing all these articles and really upset at the leadership and kind of wanting to be heard, even though, you know, like I was kicking at a giant's toe, but I just needed that, you know, I needed to do that for my own process. And reading her book was really refreshing. It was really funny, eye-opening. And I'm like, yeah, it happens to all sorts of people who have been kind of trapped in a way that really their core authentic self, whatever you want to call it, is not meant to be there. So She says, there is no right way to be. I am flawed and imperfect, but I'm uniquely me. I don't fit in and probably never will. I don't have to try anymore. That other person was a lie. And let's face it, normal is boring. We all have something to offer the world in some way, but by not being our authentic selves, we are robbing the world of something different, something special. People say that celebrities stop developing emotionally at the age of their success, which for Tom, speaking of Tom Cruise, had been with Risky Business at 21. That's what she says. Anyways, the book is really funny. You should pick it up. The last book I'm going to share with you today that also, you know, transformed me, and this is more recent, but again, confirming so many things that, you know, I already believed, but it's Educated by Tara Westover. Her story is just mind-blowing. I don't think anyone can quite relate to that. It's very unique and very heart-wrenching. It's hard, but it's good. It's so good that, I mean, yeah, you should pick it up. I'm just going to read a couple of quotes from her book. It says, you can love someone and still choose to say goodbye to them. You can miss a person every day and still be glad that they are no longer in your life. Everything I had worked for, all my years of study, had been to purchase for myself this one privilege, to see and experience more truth than those given to me by my father, and to use those truths to construct my own mind. I had come to believe that the ability to evaluate many ideas, many histories, many point of views was at the heart of what it means to self-create. If I yielded now, I would lose more than an argument. I would lose custody of my own mind. This was the price I was being asked to pay. I understood that now. What my father wanted to cast for me wasn't a demon, it was me. My life was narrated for me by others. Their voices were forceful, emphatic, absolute. It had never occurred to me that my voice might be as strong as theirs. And that, I think and feel that for, again, people transitioning from, you know, a place where leadership was all that matters, leadership was the last word, leadership was the absolute voice that needed to be followed, can really relate to that, because that father can be that the institution that acted like that and then rejects you when you disagree. These 10 books really helped me during my faith crisis and my faith transition. They helped me with solutions. They helped me with new ways of thinking. They helped me with tools, you know, to rebuild. And so I'm very grateful to all of these authors. I hope that, you know, if you haven't yet, you'll pick up some of them, if not all of them, because they're good anyways, regardless of, you know, what you're experiencing in your life. They're great, great books that expand your mind and just help you see things a little bit differently, maybe, or learn new things. So yeah, I hope that this was helpful and that will, you know, help some of you at least. Now, speaking of what can help you at the early stages of the faith crisis, when you're still in the turmoil, it's noisy, it's painful. I mean, it's just a very uncomfortable place to be at. So a while ago, back in 2015, I contributed with an article called I Am Not My Feelings. And that was to really kind of put out there some tools that are helpful during these moments of just great commotion in your mind as you're deconstructing and then rebuilding. Saying in that article, which I will put the link below, it's called I Am Not My Feelings, that the triggers of negative emotions are all around. And when we are in that mode of faith crisis, it really feels like losing control, right? And it's very easy for the negative feelings like anger and cynicism and mistrust and self-doubt to just kind of take over, and you have to extract yourself out of that because it doesn't really bring any good. It's fine to feel your feelings, but it's not great to just remain in that space. That is not helpful. At some point you get to, you know, come back into the light to say, you know, in not religious terms, but in a more peaceful place. And what really helped me with that was definitely meditation. To me, it was the perfect tool to practice quieting my mind. Even if it's just 1 minute, if you're not someone who's tried or done meditation, but just even 1 minute focusing on just your breathing can be very helpful in these moments. Now, I also in this article talk about, you know, a positive toolbox that you need to create for yourself with all the things that you know when you do make you feel better. And there are things that, you know, for me, it included meditation and fitness, eating clean, singing, dancing, piano playing, the outdoors, you know, laughing and connecting with the people I love, reading good books, listening to podcasts, you know, polishing one of the languages I've learned. So these kind of things. But it's up to you, of course, to build your own toolbox. But I know, and it's not that you have to do all of these things every day, but try to do at least two or three or more, you know, it doesn't have to be a long time, but you already know that when you do these things, it makes you feel better and happier. And so making it a habit to pull out of that positive toolbox. In fact, I had written at the time, you know, I had written all of the tools from my toolbox, like maybe on a post-it note and had it by my bed so that I could remember when I would go back into that hurt and cynicism and anger and all that, like to just look at that. Okay, what's in the positive toolbox that makes me, you know, feel better, feel happy? So if you can maybe create one of those for you, that way when, you know, you can't really think because you're just trapped in that dark space, you can look at that and it will remind you this is where the light is and this is where healing and he is and it feels better. I would also recommend seeing a therapist. Like if you're really in a bad shape and nothing works, go see a therapist. I went and saw a therapist. I went and saw several therapists and they were very helpful. They helped me see things, you know, in a different way and helping me deal with my feelings, you know, however you do that. Very, very helpful. In fact, I'm a strong believer that everybody needs a therapist or at some point go to therapy because we all have knots inside that needs to be undone and that we need to face and that we need to, you know, and keeping it there only means that sooner or later it will just come out in maybe some very weird ways. So anyways, highly encourage, you know, anyone listening to, you know, if you're struggling or things that are still sitting inside that haven't been dealt with, like just go take care of that because it's always much better after you deal with it. Yeah, you may go through a period of pain and grief and all that, but the after is just so much better. So where do I stand spiritually today? What do I believe in? You know, a lot of people have asked me that question. Today, I like to call myself spiritual non-religious. I like to just focus on being good for goodness sake, being good, doing good. I don't need, you know, explanations on everything as far as I don't need to know and understand, you know, the afterlife, for example. Like, nobody knows about that. And we're all speculating. Everyone is speculating, whether you think you're right or wrong, or even, you know, experiences, you know, people who die and then they come back and tell their experiences. Well, to me, it's just like waking up from a dream. Maybe they were dreaming whatever heaven is. And because already embedded in their brain is the language that they've been given, they can only use these words. And so it's difficult to explain things like that. Do I believe it? Do I not believe it? I mean, it's their story and I respect it. I don't say I don't believe it. How can I question? Like, if you tell me you dreamed of something and it felt really real and this is what you saw and felt, and, you know, I'm not going to say you're wrong and you're just making things up. I mean, that's your reality and that's your truth. So in my opinion, there's just a lot of speculation out there. I think sometimes people tend to focus on things that don't really make a huge difference overall. I mean, what I think makes a real difference is treating others with respect. I mean, you can't love everyone, and, you know, if you can, great. But I think that's not something that, unless you're like Mother Teresa or like some really special being. Like, it's hard to really genuinely say, I love everyone. Because if that was the case, you'd be serving out there, you know, in India, helping the lepers or whatever, like the poor people. Wherever you live, there is plenty of opportunities to love everyone and show it. So respect is about where I think, if we want to use general terms for everyone, I think respect and tolerance and just treating others the way you want to be treated, you know, let's just start there, because that alone is needs a lot of work when I look around. So how do I develop spiritually? I think developing inner quietness, inner peace, finding your core. I do believe that's important. I do believe that it makes a difference. I do believe it makes us better people when we do these things. I'm a firm believer in meditation. I try to, you know, live it every day. I am not perfect, just like anything else. You know, whether it's 5 minutes or 10 or 15, I do like to take the time. My day is actually better if I do that, you know, in the morning as my morning routine. And I'll tell you what my big fives are. So I do believe also that there is a definite connection between your physical and your mental. In order to keep your soul healthy, I don't think it's separated. You cannot be fully healthy mentally or physically if you don't take care of that soul, which to me is mind and body. So if you neglect your body, don't treat it like it's the only one you have, which is the only one you have, you're not going to be that happy mentally either. So that, I think, is a duty that we have. Of course, we have that choice not to do anything about it if we don't want to, but I do think it's a duty as human beings that we should take care of our one and only body and one and only mind. And so take care of your mental health, take care of your physical health. Like I said, I'm not perfect at that, but if I had to choose a religion, which I'm not religious, but, and we can be extreme in everything, right? But that would be my religion, is take care of your mental, take care of your body, because overall you're going to be better off. And that to me is science, and it is science. You can go and look it up and do all the research you want, but what I'm saying has been proven. So even meditation will improve your mental well-being and even your physical well-being. Yeah, that's my spirituality. Just, you know, look inside and be the best version of yourself you can be. And if you want to contribute, help those, you know, with the experiences that we have in this life, I think we are better off helping those going through similar experiences. When we have overcome something, we are, you know, better equipped, better suited to help those going through similar things. Who's right or wrong? I don't know if you've watched The Good Place on Netflix, but I really like at the beginning of the first show when she gets there and she asks, so who was right? And he says, well, you know, the Buddhists, Christianism, Islam, Judaism, they were all about 5% right, because that's what I believe. Everyone is probably about 5% right, and the rest we really don't know. So, you know, we just are left to do what we can do, and that is be good, be respectful, be kind, you know, do what you can where you can, and that's good enough. That's it. Thank you for listening today. I really hope you enjoyed. If you want to get in touch with me, you can find me pretty much everywhere on social media. The website is The Face Transition Podcast. The email address is thefacetransitionpodcast@gmail.com. Facebook is The Face Transition Podcast. Instagram is @thefacetransitionpod. So feel free to leave your comments, let me know what you think, parts that you like, things that you've learned, things that you want to add, stuff you disagree with. I just want to hear it all. And if you'd like to share a story that you would like me to bring live, feel free to send that, you know, at the email address, which is also, all of that is below. I'm happy to help give people out there a voice as well. Thank you. Thank you for joining me today. I really hope you enjoyed this episode. Remember that life has amazing things in store for you if you don't give up. I'm Juliana. This is the Faith Transition Podcast. I will see you next time.